Hello, everybody. I'm very happy to speak to you all. And I can see from the chat book or the chat window, people are joining from all over the place, Bulgaria, Middle East, here in the US, of course, and several other places. So I'm excited to talk to you all. Okay, so we proceed. And it starts by perhaps one of the most important devices in microelectronics, the transistor, which was invented back in 1947 at Bell Labs. And that invention made the transition from vacuum electronics to solid-state electronics, and resulted in all the digital and communication and electronic revolution that we're going through now, and we expect it to be with us for quite a while. And from among different types of transistors, I'm going to focus on this very one here, which is metal oxide semiconductor field effect transistor, for short referred to as MOSFET. So you'll hear the word MOSFET throughout this talk, and might want to make a note of that. Here is the schematic of the device, and it's a four-terminal device. It has a drain terminal, it has a source terminal, it has a gate terminal, and then a substrate terminal. In many applications, only the three top terminals are used, and there are some situations where the fourth terminal is incorporated. I don't want to go into the details of how this device works, but it's a four-terminal device, and what we want to get out of this device is the current between this terminal, which is the source, and the drain, and we need to modulate this current using a voltage between maybe the gate and the source, or the gate and the substrate. So it's a current generating device, and the current generated in this device is modulated by a voltage. That voltage is in a direction that's transverse to the direction of flow of current. Few important things that I'd like you to note in this device is this distance between this terminal here, which is the source, and this terminal here, which is the drain. And this distance is referred to with the letter capital L. And this distance, this dimension here, this is called the channel. And this dimension L gives us the length of this channel, which is a very important dimension in this device. Also, going down to this figure, or these two figures together, this is a typical biasing of this device. In other words, grounding the substrate and grounding the source, and then maybe applying a bias between the gate and the source, and applying a bias between the drain and the source. And the idea here is to try to get a current between the source and drain, which we call the drain current. So the current passes through the channel, which is again this length L that I referred to earlier. This is a plot of the characteristics that we get out of this device, and these characteristics are simply ID versus the voltage between the gate and the source. And again, without going into details on how these characteristics are generated, we see that we have zero current over a wide range of gate to source voltage. And then at a certain critical voltage at the gate, which we refer to as VTH here, or the threshold voltage, we get a non-zero current, or an ID non-zero current, developing between the source and drain. So, for some range of voltages between the gate and the source. No current passes through the source and drain for a given voltage between the drain and source. And as we reach a certain voltage, VTH, that's a threshold voltage between the gate and the source, for a given voltage between the drain and the source, we get a current ID or a drain current between the source and drain. So we can clearly see that there are two states for this device, and these two states are an off state for zero ID current and an on state for non-zero ID current. These two states are separated by this voltage on the gate, which we call the threshold voltage. So we can clearly see a zero and one, or an off and on state of this device, and we can immediately see that this device can act as a switch. The symbol, the electrical engineering symbol for this device is shown here, where I show the gate, the source, and the drain. Now, just going back to the schematic here, the materials that are involved in building this device would be semiconductor material, typically that is silicon nowadays, and metal plates, particularly the metal plate here at the top, which is the gate plate, and then the metal connections here at the drain and the source. And then, in between the metal gate and the semiconductor, we have an insulator, and this insulator is silicon dioxide, which is the best known insulator. Now, if we quickly go to this again, the same schematic, and if we focus on the interface between the silicon semiconductor and the insulator, which is silicon dioxide, we can see a TEM picture here of the silicon, nicely organized, single crystal silicon, and on top of it, amorphous silicon dioxide, which is the insulator. So we have one of the best known, or the best known semiconductor, which is silicon, and the best known insulator, which is silicon dioxide. And that you can see clearly here the transition from silicon dioxide to from silicon to silicon dioxide. So essentially, these are the materials that involve metals, semiconductors, and insulators, and these are the kind of characteristics that we get out of these devices. And two of the things that I should draw your attention to is the length of this channel, which is the distance between the source and drain, as well as these parameters like VTH, the voltage that it switches on the device, and then current that passes between the source and drain. So this is the important device that we want to focus on. But before we go on, just a few years after the invention of that device, another major invention came to being, and that was about 1961. And that invention came about by, you know, Jack Kilby of Texas Instruments and Robert Noyce of Fairchild Semiconductors, who both have invented the monolithic integrated circuits, which is monolithic integrated circuits is simply an electronic circuit manufactured by the pattern diffusion of trace elements into the surface of a thin substrate of a semiconductor, which is silicon in this case. And additional materials are deposited and patterned to form interconnections between devices in this circuit. So we think of this round substrate here, material here, as a silicon wafer, a very thin substrate. And on top of this substrate, with the deposition of elements and patterning, we're able to draw a circuit made up of several components, and this circuit is what we refer to as an integrated circuit. Now, because of this invention, and because of the development of this this approach of building circuits, ICs are now used in computers, they're used in mobile phones, digital cameras, digital audio devices, etc. And you can see here the 300 millimeter wafer with so many circuits that are repeated in several different dies and have been all patterned using, you know, the IC approaches. The advantage of ICs over discrete circuits are two, actually, mainly two main advantages. First of all, cost, and the second one is performance. As far as cost, and because devices are printed as a unit by photolithography rather than by that rather than being constructed one at a time, that produce that brings down the cost. Furthermore, less material is used. Also, performance is enhanced because the transistors switch quickly because they're a small size and they are in very close proximity to one another. So basically, two main inventions or the two major inventions in microelectronics that are really paramount to the industry are the invention of the transistor, particularly the MOSFET, and the second one is the ICs or integrated circuits. And here is a plot which tells us about the transistor, you know, evolution and integrated circuit evolutions and the produced chips as a result of integrated circuit processes. And that takes us all the way back to even the 1970 and before that, when we used to have only few tens of transistors per chip. And that is what people refer to as the small scale integration. And then in about the 60s, middle scale integration started. And in that era, something like few hundreds of transistors were fabricated per chip. And then that evolves to about 1970s in this region here. The number of chips, the number of transistors per chip climbed to about 10,000, few thousand transistors, 10,000 transistors or so. And that was referred to as LSI, or the large scale integration. And then in the 1980s, we have 100,000 transistors to a million transistors per chip. And that is the VLSI, or very large scale integration. And then beyond that, we go to the ultra large scale integration, ULSI, where the number of transistors per chip exceeds 1 million and approaching a billion and above. So, different numbers of transistors per chips, and we're talking here an area about 400 millimeters squared where we accommodate all these numbers of transistors. And nowadays, as I said, we reach over a billion transistors. This plot here cuts at the beginning of the 2000 and actually makes a prediction of 2007, and nowadays we are beyond that, and there are several billion transistors per chip. So in an area that is equal to roughly about 400 millimeters squared, we have something like more than billion transistors. And you can see here, as you follow these plots, you can see the different types of processors that evolved from different chip generations. You see the Pentium processors and some other processors having the number of transistors per chip. Also, with the number of transistors increasing per chip, going back from 1968 all the way to 2004, and looking at the numbers per chip, one could calculate, given the price of the chip, calculate the price of a transistor, and nowadays this is the price of a transistor that about 2004, that the price of transistor is so low as compared to the starting prices up here in 1968. So we're having more transistors per chip, millions and billions of those transistors per chip, and we're having very low prices for these transistors. So, of course, to accommodate these large numbers of transistors into a chip, and you know, with all these small prices and little material, the main approach or the main thing that people use to do this is miniaturization, making the transistors smaller and smaller. And as we go through all these generations of integration, the transistor length, channel length, or characteristic length, goes all the way from tens of microns down to few nanometers in length. Nowadays, you know, the lengths that are involved, the channel lengths of transistors that are involved, are of the order of 30 nanometers, 20 nanometers, and even down to 15 nanometers channel lengths. And these are all here were research transistors back in the years indicated here. But nowadays we see in the market transistors of channel lengths as small as 30 nanometers. And 20 nanometers and 15 nanometer generations are now being experimented with in and what I show here images from Intel Labs. And I think some of you who joined us early may have seen a video that was playing on 22 nanometer transistors that are currently being researched at Intel Labs. So, as you can see here from these SEM pictures, you know, the materials that are involved, here in this region, we have a very thin oxide, which is difficult to see, but we see also the silicon material underneath. But the main objective of this picture here is to show miniaturization as we go, you know, over the period December 2000 to today, and this is a picture that dates back to 2008. So over these 8 years, the transistor channel length goes down from 30 nanometer down to about 15 nanometer. So the magic word in microelectronics is miniaturization, making things small, and so fabricating at a small scale, and in fact at the nanoscale. And many people argue, especially those who come from electronics direction or from electrical engineering direction, that the basis of nanotechnology or nanotechnology coming to being is credited to this quest, you know, by microelectronics to go small and small. So most of the methods that are currently used in nanotechnology are borrowed from methods that are already very well developed in microelectronics industry. And we've seen, you know, the miniaturization and scaling down to nanoscale. We saw the benefits of that firsthand in nanoelectronics. Or in microelectronics. So people credit, you know, the emergence of nanotechnology to electronics and to the methods and approaches that were developed in nanoelectronics. So, why is nanotechnology important to microelectronics? Just in the previous slide, I argued that microelectronics, people argue that it is the origin for nanotechnology. Yet here in this slide, we adopt an approach, or we adopt a way of thinking that is nanotechnology is the base, and everything else is you know just drawing, you know, from nanotechnology. So we'll go ahead with that type of approach or with that type of thinking, and then try to argue why nanotechnology is important to microelectronics. Well, if we do that, The push in microelectronics is constantly towards smaller transistors. So we want to make transistors smaller and smaller. We want to make their channel length in the range of nanometers and go as small as we could. So if that's the case, then we need all the fabrication processes that nanotechnology gives us to be able to attain that objective or goal. And we, as I just argued, you know, in the previous slides, with decreasing the size of these devices, we're increasing the memory of the chip, and we're increasing its functionality, and that would give rise to new devices and new applications. Nowadays, as I said, in microelectronics, devices, transistors have channel length smaller at than 45 nanometers. In fact, just last year, 2011, devices that feature channel length of about 32 nanometers or so were out in the market. And several devices of even smaller channel lengths are being experimented with in industry fabs. So again, as Dr. Andrew Moore, a founder of Intel, observed, and this was the law that was stated back in late 70s, that the number of transistors on a chip doubles about every 10 months. So if we think of a chip size, a chip area to be constant, or roughly constant, and then if we're doubling the number of transistors every 18 months, then that implies that we're actually miniaturizing the transistors or downscaling them by the same ratio. It's not a physical law. This is an observation, actually. However, it captures the speed with which microelectronics companies are pushing towards smaller and smaller devices. The microelectronic industry uses an approach for nanofabrication approach that is called top-down nanofabrication approach. And that's an approach that was actually invented and developed by microelectronics. And apparently this top-down nanofabrication approach is the one that many other industries and many other professions and many other fields and many other applications are trying to borrow, I would say, from microelectronics, apply them to other devices and systems that are to be fabricated at a nanoscale. You know, things like sensors, things like biomedical devices, and nanoscale biomedical devices, all kind of devices that are to be integrated, you know, into a system are trying to apply this approach provided by microelectronics. This top-down approach involves four major processes. Deposition, which is literally means deposition of films of different materials, being them semiconductors, being them insulators, being them metals. Their areas might be large, meaning that they might be in the micron square range. However, the thicknesses are very small. Thicknesses could be anywhere from few angstroms to few microns. So these films are deposition, meaning deposition of films. And then another process, which is very important in top-down, is lithography. And lithography is a process whereby a pattern is transferred from a mask or a utensil, if you like, that carries a design, a particular design. Using lithography, you would want to imprint or transfer this design to a film. And it uses radiation pools, such as optical radiation, visible light, or UV light, as well as other sources of radiation, such as X-ray, or even particle beams, such as electrons, anion beams. Another process that is also involved in top-down is material modification, and that is modifying the electrical or optical or perhaps magnetic properties of the films that are deposited here at this stage. And so, for instance, changing electrical properties of semiconductors by doping semiconductors, in other words, by sending ions into a semiconductor, the special types of ions, and thereby changing the conductivity of a semiconductor. And then the fourth and also important process is etching, which is actually chemical removal of the films that are deposited, maybe removing them selectively from certain places. And if you look at these four processes that are involved in top-down, these are processes with which we build devices and structures, and these structures could be planar, and these same processes actually could be extended and used to build structures that are nanoscale, and that could be even 3D. Some people are trying to do things like that. So these are basically the four major processes, and these processes are done in a very controlled environment, a super clean environment, and this environment is what we refer to as clean rooms. Unfortunately, these processes, together with the environment in which they are performed, very expensive. I will show you that in the next slide, but that turned out to be a crucial necessity for the fabrication of such small devices. And this takes us to this slide, in which I tried to show, you know, the prices involved in building these nanofabrication facilities that utilize the top-down approach, which includes these four processes. And these facilities are called fabrication facilities, or in short, fabs. And they're for making these transistors, and they're getting more and more expensive. This is a plot which shows an exponential increase in the price of these nanofabrication facilities, and these are all standardized for a certain size or area for these facilities. And as time goes from 1990 and project to about 2010 and above, the prices of these nanofabs are, this scale here is in billions of dollars. So these prices are in the billions of dollars range, which is very expensive indeed, you know, to build these devices. Actually, it's not just, you know, building the clean rooms. It's actually most of these prices or costs going into actually building the clean environment, making the environment clean, and maintaining the environment clean, and that involves a lot of costs, as well as equipment cost. I told you about four processes that are major to top down. These processes involve equipment that are in the range of $700,000 or so, up to about $4 million per equipment. So the equipment that are involved are very expensive equipment. Some of them are high radiation equipment, or some of them are plasma equipment, etc. So these are very, very expensive equipment that are to be used. Some of the equipment approach $50 million or so, such as steppers. These are very expensive equipment, and one equipment could be about $50 million for instance, a stepper. A typical fab would have several hundreds of these equipment. So you can imagine that justifies, you know, the cost that we see here on this slide, which is in the region of billions of dollars. And nowadays, easily a fab, you know, could be built anywhere in the neighborhood of $15 billion or so. And again, that gave rise to another law, which is Moore's law. And that Moore's second law is, again, watching the increase in fabrication prices. Now, that's the case. Actually, the most expensive process in top-down is the lithography process. That involves radiation tools, as well as it involves, of course, the, you know, mass formation, etc. So this is the most expensive one. And this is actually requires the super clean environment in which we have to process these devices. So now lithography is actually pretty much what determines, you know, the miniaturization in microelectronics. Lithography is the limiting process, you know, in microelectronics. So mainly because of its prohibitive cost. So fundamental issue is that today devices are lithographically determined, and that's the heart of the top-down fabrication. And then other things like the actual real estate, the challenge with the real estate. Now you made these million, or you made these millions of devices and billions of them. You have to connect them. So you have to find the real estate, where you're going to put all these, to connect all these devices and find real estate for this, within this 400 millimeter squared real estate to connect all these devices. Here are some technical issues, you know, that apart from the costs and all things that we see, that are technical issues with the device itself. And these issues, you know, are some basic science, basic physics issues, which I'm going to highlight quickly in these two view graphs without going into details. And here again, you know, this is a schematic of the device, which is the transistor with the gate and the source and drain, etc. And of course, you know, when you have this transistor in a device of a switch, you distinguish between two modes. When you're operating your chip or your device or your system, and when you have this transistor active, and then on other situations where the transistor is inactive or not in operation, and then the issue of power consumption while the transistor is active, or if there are any issues of power consumption while the transistor is not on operation. Now, if you look quickly at this plot here, this is a plot of power consumption while one of these little transistors that we talked about is operational, or is working, or is active. And this green plot here tells us about when this same device is in a standby mode, which is not active, but having some residual voltage, but ground voltage applied to it, and no current, no significant or substantial current is expected to be withdrawn from it. So we expect no power dissipation at that in that stage or in that phase. And you can see that if you go back, you know, to the year 2000 or down to year 1970, the difference in power consumption while the device is active and while the device is inactive is very large, orders of magnitude. However, as miniaturization continued and the devices became smaller and smaller, the leakage power and the active or during operation power consumption is starting to converge, okay? And the reason behind that, the physics behind that, comes from actually building the devices or miniaturizing the devices, because making the channel length is smaller and making the devices smaller, the physics and the science of the device requires that we make the insulator, which is the silicon dioxide, thinner. And as the silicon dioxide becomes thinner, a very small voltage at the gate will cause current to pass through. And that current is referred to as leakage current. And this leakage current increases with increasing device, so with decreasing device oxide thickness, and that is to say with decreasing channel length. So, in other words, to decrease the silicon dioxide, we increase the leakage current, and therefore we increase the power consumption. So that is one of the big challenges that comes with actually miniaturizing or making things smaller. And again, to surmount that, people are thinking of alternative materials or alternative insulators to use in place of silicon dioxide, which will enable them to actually miniaturize and make devices smaller in channel length, but using a thicker insulator that replaces silicon dioxide. And for that reason, they go to higher K, that is a dielectric constant for devices, you know, which have dielectric, for materials which have dielectric constant higher than that of silicon dioxide. So the search for high K dielectrics like silicon nitride silicon dioxide, titanium oxide, zirconium silicon oxide, hafnium oxide, etc., are being used and experimented with. So people are trying to replace the silicon dioxide to suppress this leakage effect. So that is one of the big issues, and I'm going to skip this. But again, the main idea here is to preserve the structure of the transistor and just change the insulator here from silicon dioxide to another insulator which you can use and satisfy, you know, conditions for miniaturizing the device, however suppressing leakage current and reducing power. Another issue, and I mentioned that earlier on, is the real estate for actually providing all the interconnects. Now, think of this as a chip or part of a chip. And down here, we have all the transistor devices, and we have millions of them arranged at the bottom here, at the surface. And now we need to connect all these devices to make circuits. So we need metal lines to connect these millions of devices. And remember, we're talking about billions of transistors in about 400 millimeter squared real estate. So we need kilometers and kilometers of metal lines to connect all these devices into meaningful circuits. And so to provide this real estate for all these interconnects, people use multi-story building, if you like, or films of dielectrics, and then do all these interconnects at these different levels. You know, do part of them at the first inter-level dielectric, and then do another interconnects connection at the second level, third level, fourth level, etc. And so these levels, to provide real estate for interconnects, these levels nowadays approach 8, 10, and 12 interlayer dielectric levels. And the projection is that in the year 2025, we may need about 25 layers. There are so many issues, you know, again, in terms of delay of signal, in terms of response, etc., that are very critical, you know, to these dielectric properties that are used. And so people are using, you know, several tricks, you know, to come up with materials that satisfy this role. So that's another issue too. And again, here is is a view graph, is a slide which shows us this multi-level and devices down here and then metal interconnects. And then the issues that are associated with this. In addition to the issues with the interlayered dielectrics, there are issues with the resistivity of the metal linings that are used. And again, you know, going from aluminum to copper, to gain, you know, on the conductivity, lowering the conductivity and reducing power consumption. You can, because we're a little bit running behind, to proceed at this stage, and if you have any answers, I could attend to that later on. Again, in addition to material issues, material challenges, there are architectural challenges too, and so people are thinking of, you know, miniaturizing as well as changing the architecture of the transistor itself, and that way, you know, we could actually incorporate more devices on a chip without really going through several of the disadvantages that the classical structure of transistor would bring. So again, you know, there are some architectural approaches which I'm going to skip at this stage. Now, what are the alternatives? You know, given all these challenges, material challenges, architectural challenges, and as things go smaller, we have all these. Alternatives are new fabrication approaches. Perhaps, you know, just to cut on the cost, to cut on all these issues regarding materials, regarding architecture, many people have suggested that microelectronics industry has to stop using top-down nanofabrication and must move on to other approaches. One of the approaches developed and that is used in nanotechnology is bottom-up. And bottom-up approach is an approach which is mainly derived from chemistry, and it relies very much on chemical approaches, and it's a very, very less costly than the top-down approaches. So I'll give you some idea on the bottom-up approaches later on, but the two approaches that have been proposed is microelectronics that are based on nanoparticles. And by nanoparticles, we mean all particles of different shapes. The shapes could be spherical, not exactly spherical, but round shapes, or ones that are wire-like shapes, or ones that are tube-like shapes. All of these are termed nanoparticles. Nano meaning that one of the feature dimensions are in the nanoscale, anywhere from 1 nanometer to about 100 nanometers. These nanoparticles can be made using bottom-up approaches, as I will show an example of that later on, but these are purely chemical approaches. Another approach that could be used as an alternative approach is microelectronics based on ultimate nanoparticles, and the ultimate nanoparticles are molecules or a few atoms, and that is referred to as molecular electronics, or in short, as molectronics. So these are two of the approaches. So, in the nanoelectronics approach, which is the approach basically relying on nanoparticles, and these nanoparticles are born small. Remember, they could be any shapes. They could be spheres, could be wires, could be tubes, could be anything. They are small. They have some characteristic small dimension. So they are born small. Hopefully, no need for etching, no need for material removal, and no need for the very costly equipment. Hopefully also we take advantage of nature and self or inherent organization ability by these nanoparticles to organize in a special way and to make a special structure driven by chemical and biological forces rather than driven by lithography. So lithography is transferring and generating patterns. These patterns in in bottom up are self-generated by what are called self-assembly, chemical forces and biological forces. So in other words, two very big costly operations, which are the etching and the lithography, are going to be out. However, there are issues and there are things that we might take advantages of. These nanoparticles are small, and so these smaller structures would give rise to very interesting physics that we refer to as quantum confinement effects, and new physical phenomena that only occurs at that scale. So that may lead to new types of devices that are possible, new types of architectures, new types of devices, and some, you know, diverse outputs that we could actually use. Molitronics, of course, is going to use the molecules, which are inherently small, so hopefully, again, no need for etching, no need for lithography, and again, self-assembly, chemical and biological forces are be responsible for arranging these molecules and atoms in a network, in a special network, you know, satisfying certain patterns. And again, that might give rise to new types of devices. So where are we with these? Using bottom-up approaches, people can avoid lithography. So that's the hypothesis. Present state of the art, nanowires and nanotubes, these are some different types of nanoparticles, are being used and being demonstrated in some reasonable devices, and reasonable transistor action is being observed on those. Some molecular devices that use molecules, are also being researched, and some examples of these devices are being published. However, a challenge is still to assemble these devices in complex circuits and, make the complicated networks that we work with within a chip. So the building blocks, again, now here we talk about nanoelectronics. As we said, the building blocks are nanowires, nanotubes, and quantum dots. And let me quickly tell you about these. So we start with nanowires. And again, without going into details, looking here at the silicon nanowire, or how do we make silicon nanowires, this is one type of the nanoparticles that people use, or researchers use nowadays. And to make it, you use a gold catalyst, molten gold, on a substrate. That substrate could be silicon or could be any other material, could be glass. And then you pass a gas, which is rich in silicon, like silane, for instance, and at temperatures which are 363 or so, which is the eutectic point temperature for gold. So the gold is a molten gold here, and you pass this gas, which is rich in silicon. So the liquid alloy, which is the gold here, acts as the preferred sink or catalyst for the arising vapor. So apparently silicon atoms go into the eutectic liquid, and the liquid becomes saturated with silicon atoms, and the silicon, as it becomes saturated, the silicon precipitates out at the solid-liquid interface. So this is the liquid, and the solid here is a growing silicon, but here you have the liquid and the solid. So in between, you have the precipitation of silicon, and then this silicon grows, as you see green here, grows in length, producing the silicon nanowire, which is capped on the top by the catalyst gold and anchored here in the substrate. And if you go on here, you see this process and FEM of the process, and you see the cap, the gold cap here, and as the silicon nanowire grows, we see the nanowire growing vertically up, and you see the cap here. So this nanowire could be any length from few nanometers to few microns in length. However, the lateral dimension, the diameter, is in the order of few nanometers to 100 nanometers or so. And that is why it's called a nanowire. And it's a semiconductor, and it has, you know, the same characteristics, and in many cases, perhaps superior characteristics than a silicon wafer. Another nanoparticle are carbon nanotubes. Those are tubes that are made out of carbon. Carbon that is covalently bonded. Carbon atoms that are covalently bonded. These covalently bonded carbon atoms come in many shapes. All these different shapes could be like soccer ball shapes, like in carbon 60, or they could be a tube. And the carbon nanotube was observed in Japan by Sumio Ijima from NEC Corp in 1991. And the carbon nanotube is simply a tube, so it's very similar to the nanowire, except that it's a hollow tube. So it has a diameter, here we're talking about single wall nanotube, and the diameter is about 1.5 nanometer or larger. The length could be anything up to hundreds of nanometers, so we have an aspect ratio, diameter to length, or length to diameter, of the order of 1,000, maybe higher. You could have multi-walled nanotubes, so you have concentric nanotubes with several walls, separation between these walls about 0.3 nanometers, and again, the length could be anything, or the diameter could be anywhere from 10 nanometers up to about 100 nanometers or so. Here are just schematics of these different types of nanotubes. They're all carbon atoms. Here you see, we can imagine a sheet of graphene, which is actually a network of carbon atoms that are bonded covalently with one another, making a very thin sheet. And imagine that you fold this sheet into a cylinder. This cylinder, made up of one sheet, would be a single wall and the carbon nanotube, and the diameter would obviously be very small. And the way this sheet is wrapped pretty much determines the characteristics, optical, mechanical, or electrical, of the different nanotubes. So this is single-walled nanotubes. Here is multi-walled nanotubes. So you can see that concentric carbon nanotubes, and the separation between them is of the order of 0.1 nanometer to 0.5 nanometer, so you have multi-wall nanotube structure. So these are the different types of carbon nanotubes. Carbon nanotubes are amazing materials in the sense that you have a variety of properties, electrical or mechanical properties, that are associated with these nanotubes. Variable properties depending on how these nanotubes are wrapped, and you have your dimensions up to 1 to 2 nanometers for single nanotubes, typical length up to about 1,000 nanometers. However, the electrical properties are described by this parameter here, which is the band gap, and this is considered to be a very wide variation of a band gap, which would provide different conducting properties, ranging all the way from metallic to semiconducting, and then things like providing resistivities all the way from 10 to minus 4 to 10 to minus 3 ohm centimeter to about 10 ohm centimeters, so covering a very wide range. One interesting aspect is here in the elastic modulus, that is the strength, the mechanical strength of these nanotubes, 1,000 to 3,000 gigapascal Young's modulus. And just to give you an idea, that is about 5 times stronger than stainless steel. So in other words, if you take carbon nanotubes pound to pound, compare them to stainless steel, they're more than 5 times stronger elastic modulus for stainless steel is only 200 gigapascal. So we have nanoparticles here that go all the way from metallic to semiconductors, stronger than stainless steel, large range of thermal conductivity, etc., depending on how we actually wrap them and how we make them. And they're all made of the same atom carbon covalently bonded. So obviously, you know, there is much room using carbon nanotubes as transistors. And here again, going back to the same structure that we talked about, the MOSFET, source, drain, and then a silicon dioxide, the oxide, and then a metallic gate silicon. But now you have replaced the bulk silicon, which used to be the substrate, by a carbon nanotube. People are experimenting with those now, and they're seeing an drain current versus a drain voltage or a gate voltage, which are very much which resemble very much those of the conventional transistor. We here at Penn State also were lately involved with silicon nanowires. Again, here we see the silicon nanowire, and we see a drain on the source, and this is one of the structures that we recently experimented with. And again, we clearly see transistor behavior coming from this silicon-based nanowire transistor, and we're doing measurements regarding, you know, the interface between the oxide and the silicon nanowire. So these devices are now in the phase of experimentation, and hardly any applications or application devices of such are out in the market now. Now again, quickly here, just looking at this, I told you about the nanoparticles and how they're generated, and using the simple chemical approaches, and then later on being involved in bottom-up processes. And here is a very simple process that tells us, you know, how we produce these particles, and the processes that are involved are purely chemical processes. And just to give you an idea on some of the processes that are used here, basically they're mostly chemical and they involve chemical solutions. So here what we're trying to generate are cadmium sulfide nanoparticles. Think of them as just simple spheres of a simple sphere of radius, few nanometers, you know, anywhere from 5 to 100 nanometers. And the way to make them is purely chemistry, you know, just using traditional heating and temperature controlled systems, and coordinating solutions, inorganic solutions here, like TOPO and HPA here, at temperatures about 270 to 320, depending on the coordinating solution. And then through this syringe here, injecting precursors that actually have the atoms that are involved in building these nanoparticles. So we're trying to build a cadmium selenide nanoparticle, which we refer to as a quantum dot here. So we have, you know, precursors that have cadmium and another precursor that has selenide, inject them through this syringe, and then have them react in this coordinating solution at this temperature in an argon gas flow with a controlled temperature. And eventually, you know, by controlling the temperature, controlling the time of reaction, chemical reaction, and controlling the coordinating solutions, etc., one could control the size of the nanoparticle as the, you know, the reaction goes on. And now these nanoparticles could be collected in powder form or in liquid form, different sizes. Think of them, as I said, as spheres having diameters anywhere from 3 nanometers to 8.3 nanometers. And nanoparticles under these dimensions, this is as close as we can get to some simple molecules or simple atoms. So the behavior or the physics behind the optical behavior, optical absorption, and optical emission of these, particles pretty much resembles that of atoms. And so without going into details, what would happen with these nanoparticles is that, depending on their size, they're able to absorb light and emit light at a special frequencies. And as, you can see here, we have, you know, all the different sizes, and we have all the different emissions that come up, come out of these sizes. So these nanoparticles could be used in display applications, electronic display applications, because of the very nice coloration and emissions that come out of them depending on the size of these nanoparticles. I'm getting, I'm being asked, you know, to quickly wrap this, but we only have few graphs to go through. And here is another application that uses quantum dots or nanoparticles, and that is in solar cells, incorporating them in films in solar cells, and that way enhance, you know, absorption, light absorption, and enhance the efficiency of solar cells. So I'll quickly go through that. Another application, you know, for or another way, you know, to that we discussed in addition to nanoelectronics, we talked a little bit about molecules, and that involves molecules. And again, instead of using nanoparticles in transistors, we are going to use molecules for these switching properties. And here I'm just borrowing, you know, and I myself do not work in this area, but here is a picture showing a molecule and two electrodes, metal electrodes, connected to this molecule, and then apparently a transistor action has been reported, you know, by applying voltage across this molecule, and transistor action has been reported. This is back in 2004. More work is being done on this, both theoretically and experimentally. And the idea is to develop transistors that are made up of single molecules. And that I think will conclude my talk, and we'll stop at this point and see if we can attend to any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wadel Karim. That was a lot of good information, valuable information for our participants. So this is from pretty early on in the presentation. The participant asks, in your opinion, what is the biggest challenge for the continuation of Moore's Law?
Okay. So in other words, you know, the question, just to rephrase it, is, the challenges that I pointed out basically are some material challenges. Moore's law is all about miniaturization, making things smaller and smaller. I'm talking about miniaturization law. So there are material challenges. I mentioned, you know, in the talk that people are investigating, you know, high K materials and are actually using high K materials in many of transistor applications. There are so many issues with high K materials in terms of, you know, their reliability, in terms of their electrical properties, that's their insulation capabilities, their breakdown, etc. They're much less studied compared to silicon dioxide, which has been used for so many years. So that is one of the big challenges. Another challenge is, as we go smaller and smaller, we get to a situation where the basic transistor physics that actually provide us, you know, with this switching properties and all the characteristics, the current voltage characteristics that we see, are all based on a good deal, you know, of classical physics. As things get smaller and smaller, we go more into the quantum physics region, and a lot of the theory that is already there might, you know, collapse, if you like, quote unquote, when you get to the quantum region or the quantum scale. So that would require, you know, the development of perhaps, you know, new sciences, and I mentioned that, you know, in one of the slides, saying that a new physics, a new science, new applications, and new properties, new IV characteristics might come out of that. Of course, there are some architectural issues too, and there are issues, you know, regarding interconnects, you know, and delay, etc., as I mentioned. So there are so many issues, and people are just continuing researching and working on those.
Okay, thank you very much for the answer. I do have another question here. The question from our participant is, how close are they to using nanoelectronics or Multronics in production on our computers?
Okay. First of all, you know, a basic issue, I think, with nanoelectronics and Multronics are issues of understanding the real transport properties. You know, we're struggling with understanding very well transport properties in molecules. And that's one issue. The other issue is reproducibility. You know, we get so many results that are reported from different labs by different authors, you know, and these results vary all over the place, and repeatability of results are issues. Reliability of devices, if you use these devices, whether them being based on nanoparticles or based on molecules, the reliability, the lifetime, etc., all of those are not very well understood at this stage. Some people also, you know, there are issues like, you know, generating complicated circuits, like nanotubes, nanowires are produced, and now we don't have a full control or a full hand on how we produce them and organize them orderly in the form of circuits. What we have in hand now to do that, we're relying on self-assembly. But that is very limited, and given the complexity of electronic circuits in a chip, there are still a lot of issues there and a lot of challenges before, you know, we can see really these devices incorporated in production. And that is why a lot of the time and the money spent by big IC makers is still in trying to take advantage as much as possible of the present capabilities that we have with the present devices.
Okay, we do have one more question. Can I ask that right now?
Yeah.
Okay. So a participant had asked early on, when you were showing some details of the transistors, what were those different layers made out of?
What I was trying to say here is we have so many devices, millions of devices down here. And then we have to connect these devices to make meaningful circuits in a chip. So we need metal lines. So you can think of all these as metal lines. Mm-hmm. It's very poorly colored. So these are metal lines, and millions of devices. We need kilometers and kilometers of metal lines. We cannot accommodate those on 400 millimeter squared chip. So what we have to do is start connecting in this level. Say, call it level one. Okay. And this level is a level of a dielectric. In other words, it insulates, you know, the devices from one another, and it insulates the metal lines. So we make some connections on this level, and then we go ahead and deposit another level on top, you know, of the whatever metallization, we call it metal one, that we made in the dielectric level one. So we continue. Now we have another layer of dielectric. This dielectric mainly is TEOS, triorthosilicate silicate, which is a form of silicon dioxide. And then we punch through vias and put metal, and then do some connections, you know, metal two, some connections of the interconnections here, and then we deposit another same dielectric layer, TEOS, and then metal plugs here, and then another dielectric, and so on. So you build up, you know, multi-story building. And the idea is, at each level, you have a large real estate for doing some of the metal connections. And then you go ahead and put another dielectric to isolate these metal lines that you've already patterned, and then dig, you know, holes or vias or plugs through, and then go on and build another metal connection on the second level. And so, depending on how many devices you have here at the bottom, and how many miles or kilometers of metal interconnect you need, you build, you know, you deposit more and more layers of these dielectrics. And if you remember one of the very early slides, I showed that, you know, the prediction at about 2025, and if we continue with the present rate, we'll probably need 27 layers of these dielectrics to accommodate all the metal interconnects.